Dog conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is Dialogue Conspiracy 229. I was wrong on the numbering last week, so I hope you caught the error. If you take the shows regularly, August the 9th, 1976. The news this week, this morning in the newspaper about the new Playboy article coming out on CIA and Howard Hughes. It's a very important article. I haven't read it yet, but there's an advanced resume of it. New evidence of the links of the CIA to the Howard Hughes Corporation. And of course, I'm interested in that subject. I'm spending the entire summer working on a book on that matter and into the fall. I think it's the most important story in the United States that culminates a whole era since World War II that has to do with murder, kidnapping, sabotage, suppression, and most important of all, a robbing of our electoral process. The Playboy article goes into the funding of 31 U.S. congressmen, including Gerald Ford, and there's a list of several of the men: Robert Leggett, James Eastland, Strom Thurmond, John Tower, Robert Byrd, Hiram Fong, Wilbur Mills, and that's just five or six. You could probably, I just could make a guess on the other 25 and even more. And this new article coming out says the Hughes Medical Foundation was a tax-exempt institution by the IRS, which went to fund these various politicians. The politicians can say that they didn't know their money came from the Hughes Corporation, but just by coincidence, they vote unanimously on the same bills all the time. The Senate is just a complete blanket approval of everything that happened, such as the nomination of Gerald Ford as a former member of the Warren Commission, who suppressed evidence of a murder and should have been impeached or never put in power as president. The use of the Hughes Medical Foundation, the Institute of the Summa Corporation, or this dummy front to fund our congressmen is that they don't represent the people from these 30 geographical areas, and there's more than 30 congressmen. I would say out of a Congress of hundreds, that there must be literally hundreds of people that are funded and controlled by the Hughes Corporation. I even am suspicious of the money behind Jimmy Carter. He was involved with the relationships of Lockheed down in Georgia, and there were scandals of Lockheed money. It still isn't cleared up in Japan and in Holland, and the money from Jimmy Carter, whatever it goes to him, there's some from Rockefeller, David Rockefeller. He attends the Trilateral Commission, which has to do with Holland and the Japanese area where Lockheed money went. And the payment in Lockheed, incidentally, every $10,000 was referred to on the books as peanuts. And I've called the Carter people down in Atlanta, Georgia, to clear out what this means and to see if even Jimmy Carter in this election is also owned by Lockheed, and Lockheed is Howard Hughes, and Hughes and CIA are one. And these answers don't come from Georgia very easily. I get the runaround, but they're important because we know that this funding for the Hughes Corporation goes to Ronald Reagan through Paul Assault, the former governor of Nevada, and he's managing the campaign for Ronald Reagan, and Gerald Ford funded through these people. So this is a new tip of the iceberg. There's some things in the Playboy article, the resume, that I've seen that I don't agree with. According to Playboy's research, the Hughes relationship with Nixon began in 1956 when he made a loan to Donald Nixon of $205,000. That's totally untrue. The relationship of Howard Hughes to Nixon began in 1946 when Richard Nixon was running for Congress, and he was still in the service in the Navy, Navy intelligence, and he was called by a gentleman to come to California, and he went to the bungalow of Howard Hughes at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Richard Nixon was not lined up to the Hughes Corporation in 56. It started in 46, which is even more insidious, and Nixon was put in the House of Representatives along with Mr. Smathers from Florida and a team that had combined with various congressmen around the country who approved in 1947 of the Central Intelligence Agency charter, and they were handpicked as early as 1946 to vote for the charter and have worked as agents of the CIA with them, for them ever since. I'm just briefly going to do a rundown for a minute or two on Chowchilla today because I've done 3 weeks on it, and I'll do more next week. I want to get to another subject at length now. The first week that the children were kidnapped on the bus, I did a show and dialogue conspiracy with the allegations that the officials should look into the Zodiac organization, the Zodiac killer known as the International White Guard. I believe that this man belongs to this group. And remember, there was somebody with a French accent also that the children, the bus driver, had heard. And I called a David Tosche from the San Francisco Police Department about the Zodiac killer and see the connections to the Chowchilla bus. And I telephoned Mr. Sherwood Morrill from Sacramento, retired from CIA criminal investigation, the expert on Zodiac handwriting. The second week, the suspects had been arrested, the second week of dialogue conspiracy on the Chowchilla case, and I said that there were masterminds behind these three suspects and that a woman or women were involved, just like there were masterminds behind the California violences and murders, and women were involved in each one of these cases. And I listed these various large cases of mass killings, like the one Corona killing of migrant farm workers up in Yuba City, and the killings in the Santa Cruz area, and this bus kidnapping. The third week, last week on Dialogue Conspiracy, the case was for all purposes closed by the law enforcement. They were going to do a psychological profile, and I called Alameda County and compared the kind of work they want to do to the Lee Harvey Oswald, the Sirhan, the James Earl Ray psychological profiles, and objected to their suppressing evidence about this case that involves other people and zeroing in on just three people and letting the support team, identical to the Manson family, the Charles Watson murders, or the SLA and the Santa Cruz murders, or the major assassinations, the political assassinations, the support team fades away and the selected patsies take the rap. Well, last Monday I talked about that psychological profile, and Tuesday afternoon on San Francisco news station and TV, Stan Borman was on the air, and he said that the suppressed letter that was found in the home of one of the persons arrested, Mr. Woods, Frederick Woods, was released for one short hour, evidently. And he said that the writing compared the Zodiac killer, that there were markings above and below the letter, and there were references to the occult. And this is what I had told the police 3 weeks earlier. But if you didn't hear about the comparisons to the Zodiac writing, it's not a... any problem on your ears not being able to hear it, because immediately all that evidence was taken off the news. And you can check with Stan Borman. This was on August 3rd, the comparison of the note that they were going to send to the Zodiac writing. It was unsigned and undated. Now, all of a sudden, the evidence in that case, instead of being released, was locked up again, and Judge Howard Green put a new gag order into effect as of that moment. I listened to 6 o'clock news, no mention of the Zodiac, the 10, 11 o'clock news, a repeat of the early evening news with no mention of the similarities to the Zodiac letter. And then a legal maneuver went into position by Thursday, August the 5th, and the judge moved that the case would be presented to a new county grand jury for indictments. And this is a quote from the Associated Press: "Such a strategy would avert the necessity for the state to expose its evidence in an open court and a preliminary hearing." Now, what I think probably will happen was that the men will be forced maybe to plead guilty to some minor charges, and then this will never be available for us at all. So I think it's important, particularly the people listening in Sacramento, to check out the newspaper articles and the allegations that came out for one moment on the Zodiac and see if we can get some of this information or evidence made public, even if they force the men to plead guilty and end the trial. The other new evidence... this week, the bus driver went to the arraignment, and he sat in front, and he was interviewed at Mr. Ray. What did he think of the men that he saw there? He was not asked by the law enforcement if these men appeared familiar. Ray sat 10 feet from the captors, and he was not asked by anyone to if he recognized the men, and he said he wasn't asked by the authorities to study the arraignment. And last week, I said on Dialogue Conspiracy that I'd called the... law enforcement up in Alameda County and Chowchilla, and they said that the bus driver wasn't important to the case or the three men that were picked up as far as tattoos and chipped tooth or mole on their face. he didn't know what was involved. This is what I was told by the law enforcement in tapes, that conversation, and therefore he wasn't even asked if he identified these men, even though their descriptions are different than the men that were arrested. Also, a link to Vandenberg Air Force Base came out this week. The sheriff's disclosed that the two kidnapped victims had mentioned the names Fred and James in front of the kidnappers, but they also found a man who used the name of Mark Hall and a fictitious Vandenberg Air Force Base address, and he had stayed in the area in June in a motel, and published newspaper reports said that a man using the name of alias Mark Hall had bought the moving van that kept the children at the rock quarry. So a man with this alias was buying the van. He was the one that was used at the rock quarry. He was in town in June, and he was linked to Vandenberg Air Force Base address in some way, which again doesn't surprise me. Also, I had mentioned to Mr. Tashi, police chief in San Francisco, originally in charge of the Zodiac case, I had mentioned that the Zodiac White International Guard involved the son of a famous Hollywood TV actor. And this week, a Hollywood connection came out from the Oakland Tribune. There was an article that said the friends of James Schoenfeld said he spoke to a man named Fred, who had talked to a man, Dave, from Los Angeles about a script for a scenario for a movie about the kidnapping. The Bay Area authorities are discounting anyone by either Mark Hall or the man Dave or in Hollywood or the connections in Hollywood. And yet these should be investigated, and the police know about the Hollywood connection, and according to their own admission, they haven't pursued it all these years, even though they've had the names for a long time. Another point of interest is that in every government conspiracy or counterintelligence program, there's an author in residence, such as when Robert Kennedy was killed, Robert Kaiser wrote RFK Must Die. Marilyn Vega wrote The Exclusive, The Story of SLA. And now the man to write the story of the Madera, the bus kidnapping, is going to be Madera County Sheriff Ed Bates. And he is not going to write about the safe houses, the aliases, the driver's license, the Reno connections, the weapons they unloaded. He's going to do that psychological profile like Gerald Ford did on Lee Harvey Oswald, called The Portrait of the Assassin. Now, Sheriff Bates from Madera County just happened to be in the U.S. Navy as a code breaker during World War II. He's already started tape recording his book. He said, in quotes, "I'm going to do a psychological and sociological study of these guys. I'm going to do that myself personally, even if I take a vacation to do it. I want to know what makes them tick. It doesn't satisfy me to know they did it for money. I want to know why and how they were going to use the money." Now, this reminds me of the Boston Strangler, the story of DeSapio, who was arrested, and CIA lawyer F. Lee Bailey came to fame defending DeSapio. There was no evidence against this man that he had killed any of the nurses. He was never tried in a court of law because there was no evidence that he did it. The DA in Boston became famous. Bailey became famous. The Boston Strangler is still out at large. DeSapio was locked up and killed in jail. We never got to hear a word from him. And the lawyers and judges become famous. The mass murders are allowed. The patsy is selected and silenced, and the books go out. Bates says he knows what the kidnappers plan to do with the children. He joined the Merchant Marines at age 16. He went to the University of Colorado before he went in the Navy. And his last assignment, it seemed, was be to study advanced criminology at the FBI Academy at the University of Virginia. Now, the University of Virginia FBI Academy is where Donald Gray teaches. He's the nephew of L. Patrick Gray. I've said that he was brought out to Los Angeles. There's allegations he was brought to Los Angeles to shoot Donald DeFreeze from inside, from the alley inside the house at close range before the place was burned down. He teaches at Guantanamo at the Academy in Virginia. It would be interesting to know if this counterintelligence operation of the Chowchilla bus fare, if the professor for Sheriff Ed Bates from Madera County was Don Gray at the University of Virginia FBI Academy. It's a small world, but it's not that small. We can trace those connections and who the teachers were if the proper people were interested. Now, I'm just going to mention a little bit about John Roselli, and then I'm going to talk at length about another matter. I have a guest today, my son. Marvin is here, and we're going to talk a little bit about the CIA and drug testing because of news this week, some more news that came out about the MK Ultra plan of the Army and the CIA, and I've talked about experiences he's had on KLRB, but some more news came out this week, and I want to share it with you and let him tell you about it firsthand. But before we just get to that, I want to talk about John Roselli, who was murdered this week. He's an organized crime figure who was used by the Central Intelligence Agency, again hired by Robert Mayhew for an assassination team. And with his news breaking in Playboy, you can get the links of Mayhew to the Hughes Corporation and the Hughes Corporation to the CIA. Both Roselli and Giacano were to testify at the Senate committee this last year, and at the time they were to testify, Giacano was murdered, and Roselli gave a few words. He didn't say much in his testimony, and then July 29th, just last week, he was found, his car was found, and he was found dead this weekend in a drum that was supposed to sink in the ocean over Miami. Roselli was arrested in 1968 for cheating at the Friars Club in Beverly Hills, California, and he worked with a gambling syndicate at the time. And Roselli was important because the lawyer representing him was Grant Cooper. And after Sirhan Sirhan was arrested for allegedly killing Senator Robert Kennedy, the trial was held up because they needed only Grant Cooper could be Sirhan's lawyer, even though in the case Grant Cooper told the jury that his client was guilty. The lawyer that represented Sirhan was Roselli's lawyer just prior to that case. And Roselli was hired by Robert Mayhew, as I say, who worked with the FBI and the CIA. And in 1967 and 68, Robert Mayhew was siphoning off $1 million, allegedly from the Hughes Silver Slipper Casino in Las Vegas, as payoffs for these various political campaigns for the 68 campaign. And in March 14th, 1968, the Hughes Empire had a counterintelligence operation going. And I'm going back to the role of Mayhew and Roselli to show you how influential they were in the elections and the importance that Roselli later has and possibly linked to the Hughes Empire. In 68, just prior to Robert Kennedy's killing, a memo that was supposed to come from Hughes and actually came from the CIA Hughes connection said, "I want you to go to see Nixon as my special confidential emissary. I feel there's a really valid possibility of a Republican victory this year. It could be realized under our sponsorship and supervision every inch of the way when we would be ready to follow with LaSalt as our next president." Now we have the interim of Ronald Reagan, but LaSalt is managing his campaign. Now, Roselli was being paid by Robert Mayhew and these various people at a time he was working with them and had worked in their operation. He had Grant Cooper, who was Sirhan's attorney. And Roselli also was important because he worked with a group known as Emprise, which is a link of organized crime and various scandals. You've heard that name Emprise recently with Mr. Don Bowles, the newspaper writer, who was blown up in June 1976 in Phoenix, Arizona. And the last words he said when he was dying was, "Emprise finally got me." And I think the reason John Roselli was murdered at this time was not so much his links even to the assassinations, maybe because the story would break of his possible use in political assassinations by the Hughes Empire, but I think he had to be murdered at this time because of his links to Emprise and Don Bowles' link to Emprise. Because Bowles was investigating not only organized crime, which he'd done for years, but he was into real estate and mining frauds, and he was getting, in quotes, too close to the top. He was starting to link important political figures, such as a Republican Representative Sam Steiger, Phoenix, Arizona, and Senator Goldwater. And I think Emprise is like the word rosebud, if you saw the movie of Citizen Kane. Emprise is a magic word to Roselli, and who's now dead, and to Don Bowles, who's dead. And I think the connecting link has to do with a Hughes connection up in Montreal in 1971 after Hughes had left Las Vegas. His chief aide, Howard Eckersley, was in Montreal selling false stock on the Montreal stock market, and he had a prospectus saying that Howard Hughes was behind land and mine deals that happened to be in Phoenix, Arizona. And the name of the mines were the Pan American Mines. And the actual storefront was in Flagstaff. It was a $15 bank account. It was a nothing office. And Eckersley was sought for arrest by the Canadian officials. But at the time, Montreal was trying to link these people, the Pan American Mines and the Hughes people, to a mafia member, Joseph Zuccarelli, and organized crime, and make a connection of the Hughes-Eckersley connections between Montreal and Phoenix, Arizona, and land fraud. And the magic word was emprise in this, and that's what Don Bowles died from, and I think this is what John Roselli died from. And I think the killing of Roselli would be imminent also because of his meetings with Mrs. Exner, because now she can write a full-scale book about John Kennedy and his sexual expertise. You know, she can really get full steam on that now because Roselli's dead and Giacana's dead and Kennedy's dead. So now we can get all kinds of versions of funky sex or whatever you want to talk about because the parties are dead and it's open field day to continue to smear that whatever is left of the Camelot legend. One other subject before we get to the CIA articles this week, and I did want to go into the flu vaccine, but I'm going to have to put that off till next week and do that. I want to get on to the CIA drugs and mind control. I spoke last week about a trial in San Jose of a Mr. Abkalitz, A-A-B-C-A-L-I-X-Y-Z. It involved a murder at Hunter Liggett, where a woman was killed, and Charlie Bates, FBI in San Francisco, was in on the case. And various people, several people who listened to the show went up with me to the trial last week and the week before, and this man was going to be released, and I felt that he was under a mind control program and possibly a zombie used for various killings on a government base or elsewhere, and followed the case up there. And I'd called Jim Easton at KGO, and the San Jose Mercury was there. I'd called a newsman from KOME. So there was quite an attendance this time. And the public defender was completely caught off guard at the trial because his party was not going to have a dismissal. They had moved for a dismissal of the case, even though he had killed a woman in South Dakota and escaped from a jail in South Dakota and had killed a woman in California. There's no question about identification or anything. It was just a question of his having the case dismissed. And another listener wrote a letter up to KGO, and they called Mr. Bates of the FBI. And the result of this case was that the prosecution came in the day before the hearing that we went to last week in San Jose. They came in with a prosecution, an indictment, a charge of murder, a charge of kidnapping, and a charge of having concealed weapon. And the defender thought his client was going to get free. It's a strange twist for me. You help so many people try to get out of jail and work for innocent people locked up to ever have a role, to feel that even the wheel started moving to put somebody in, even temporarily, who should not be out on the streets and doing these crimes. But I know the intelligence community and the Army have killers that they allow to go from one place to another place, and the only way we are going to protect ourselves is to keep on top of these trials and not allow them out on the streets and to end using these provocateurs and see that they do remain confined so other people can go about their business without being murdered, you know, and the trial is covered up and the people go on to their next assignment. Well, I've talked about mind control and behavior modification quite a bit on different programs at KLRB and public lectures because it's the number one problem in the country. The proliferation of weapons by the Pentagon is just terrible. And the controls, the laws that we've had, some of them are pretty rigid methods of control. But the most dangerous, taking away our whole privacy and the right to our own minds, is to me the most insidious thing. And people who are interested in pollution of the land or recycling bottles or glasses and a lot of ecology don't really study or fight or work hard enough on the mind control evidence. So there were articles, the Los Angeles Times this week had a long article about Alan Dulles and the CIA developed truth drugs used by narcs. And the Los Angeles Times said that drugs were tested at the state medical facility in Vacaville and the U.S. Drug Treatment Center in Frankfort, Connecticut, in Kentucky, rather. Now, it's interesting that the San Francisco Chronicle Examiner left out the name Vacaville, even though the CIA document clearly states it was Vacaville, and I've said this all along in the use of programming Donald DeFreeze to set up that SLA. Vacaville has done a lot more. Alan Dulles, according to documents as early as 1953, had a comprehensive program to test methods of controlling human behavior through drugs, radiation, electroshock, psychology, psychiatry, sociology, anthropology, harassment substance such as tear gas, hypnotism, hyponarcoanalysis, which is the use of drug and hypnotism, and ultrasonics, which is loud noises. The program was MK Ultra. And this is a program that went on. The CIA bought $240,000 worth of LSD, and they had enough that Alan Dulles ordered to turn on 100 million American citizens, which is one half of our population. And then the article which interested me was the New York Times article, August the 7th, by Joseph Trester. Report on Army drug tests tell of efforts of concealment. And this is the story of the Army taking people, unsuspecting persons, and giving them, patients, drug, which passed itself off as LSD, which was, in quotes, not for the benefit of the patient, but an attempt to create an exaggerated mental state of schizophrenia. Now, when you create schizophrenia, then you have the excuse for Thorazine and Prolixin, and then you create the drugs to cure the schizophrenia, and then you turn political prisoners and old people and young people and hippies and protesters and political people into literal zombies. And the prison systems, if you read recently, they've given them heavy doses of these medications that they can't defend their own rights. Well, I talked at KLRB about a member of my family, my son, getting this LSD. We knew right from the beginning, I knew that he had this kind of LSD, and I was criticized once for referring to LSD. I'm not saying that all LSD causes you to be schizophrenic. What I'm saying is that the government created specific drugs to cause schizophrenia, and they are even releasing these documents under the Freedom of Information Act now, as well as all these other methods of control. So I have Marvin here. I want you to meet my son, Marvin Goodwin, and we're going to talk about his schizophrenia that the Central Intelligence Agency gave to him in 1967, and let him share with you, because when you read a New York Times article or Los Angeles Times, it's still a piece of paper, but maybe you know someone who's had these same experiences. So he's going to be on the show with me to talk about what we went through, his experience with LSD. Mm-hmm. Where will we start, Barb?
I'm not exactly sure. Have we decided to name the people involved? No.
Well, I may as this program goes on. I'll say, let's put it this way. We can name the people that gave you the LSD. They lived on the Monterey Peninsula, and I'll protect them and us by saying maybe they didn't know it was a poison. But if they were your friend, one was a writer like E. Howard Hunt. Mm-hmm. You can name him.
Sure. Peter Gilman is his name.
Peter Gilman. He wrote the book Diamond Head, and his wife is Carolyn Gilman, who moved to town and took over the books from the Peace and Freedom Party and had a store on the down at the wharf, the Calliope. Mm-hmm. And Peter came on, interested in my research.
Yeah.
It was around 1967, before I went to New Orleans to see Jim Garrison.
Right. And his entry into the house was sort of in order to help you write a book, which never got written, but some funny things happened that summer.
Yeah, he was going to help me write a book.
Right.
And you met him through at the house he came.
Yeah, right. He invited me to live at his house in the Highlands with him and his wife.
Marvin was earning about $150 a week at the time.
Right.
You might as well tell what you were doing at the time.
19 years old. I was going to UC Santa Cruz. It was in its second year. I was holding down a songwriting job with Bobby Darin's company in L.A. and spending the summer in Carmel between my freshman and sophomore years in college. And Peter came into the house and, as I said, invited me to live with him and his wife, and I took him up on it. I decided to go live with them, and I guess that was the beginning of what we're going to get into.
Yeah, well, at the time also, Marvin was going to group therapy with Eric Byrne, mm-hmm. and seeing Eric Byrne once a week at a group thing, and spending the summer here in Carmel, and he moved down the Highlands, mm-hmm. and Peter said he was going to give you some acid, or he
wouldn't do it. No, I'll tell you exactly what happened. See, I won't say anything that I don't recollect absolutely, but toward the beginning of my stay at his house, which was a 6-week stay, I was talking with him about acid. It was like the summer of love in 67, and he said that he'd tried it and that he wouldn't turn anyone on to it for the first time, but there was some in the house, you know.
Yeah. And what did Carolyn tell you
about
him?
You know, for the next 6 weeks, I did know that there was some in the house, and I had never tried it.
No.
And a lot of people were trying it, and the reports of bad trips were not that common in those days.
When he gave you that, they cut it in a quarter piece or something like that. What did she tell you was going to happen?
Basically, well, a few things which I think are pertinent to the entire story are that, for one thing, she came to me once in private, and it's like her conscience cracked, and she was saying to me, "You don't know the man. He'll hurt you. He hurts people. Look out for him. He's, you know, dangerous to you." And I thought, like, she was a little hysterical about it, and I thought she was upset over a marital squabble. She wouldn't qualify anything that she was saying, and I didn't take it seriously. And toward the end of the 6 weeks, like a week before I was going back to Santa Cruz to start the sophomore year, I just decided that I would try it.
Yeah. There were people at the house, but they weren't given the same.
Right.
They were the only person.
Another interesting thing is that they'd gotten it, to the best of my recollection, they'd gotten it from somebody in Big Sur, and I believe...
Don't mention that name.
Okay, I won't mention the name.
Another writer. Lee Howard Hunt writer.
Right, who I occasionally have seen tremble when I see the man in a bar down there. And they said they weren't sure whether or not it was LSD that they were giving me.
Uh-huh.
But they kind of thought it was.
Afterwards, when you were in the hospital, you sort of remember taking something different than LSD. What happened was that after you took it, you went back up to Santa Cruz and then threw your car key away, remember, and called and said you were having a massive heart attack. You became
like
catatonic.
Yeah. I'll tell you exactly what happened. Like, I took it, I ingested the pill, and Peter and Carolyn, like, Carolyn brought me flowers and an apple, and Peter brought me a book of art masterpieces, and I was supposed to see these as, you know, something more beautiful than I'd seen them as in the past, and I didn't really see any difference. I was a little psyched out, and I noticed that I was kind of tense. I wasn't hallucinating, and the apple tasted like an apple, which is delicious, and the flowers were pretty, of course, and, you know, great art is always going to be great art, you know, and I went for a drive with Carolyn. A funny thing happened on the drive. Like, I wasn't on a bum trip, but as we were driving, like, I started having what I later learned to recognize as a psychotic symptom, like something was really dreadfully wrong. I wasn't losing my mind. And we stopped at the house of some friends of mine, and I had an entirely different perception of these people. And, like, it wasn't a hallucination. It wasn't beautiful. I wasn't panicking. But, like, maybe I was just very, very psyched out and very tense over thinking that I had, you know, thinking about having taken it. So we finally, you know, got back to the house where I ingested it. And after a few hours, you see, I couldn't tell that I was on a trip, so they kind of assumed that, you know, my trip was coming to an end. I went back to school the next week, and, you know, I did a lot of thinking about the so-called trip during the week before school. And, like, a week after I got to school, I started having the weirdest feelings in my body. Like, my muscles became very tense, felt like my legs were made of wood, and my mind was okay until my mind could no longer cope with this strange physical sensation that I was feeling. And I'd always been a very healthy, vibrant person, you know, physically, intellectually, mentally, creatively, in good health. And all of a sudden, like, my body was doing something very strange, and I guess I started worrying about it, and that's what led to what, I guess a week later, was called a nervous breakdown. I was having horrible gas pains in my chest.
But when you came back to the house, Marvin's father lives in Los Angeles, and he's a doctor, and he said, "I can get the best medical care," and by then you thought you were having a heart attack, and your mind was completely gone, and they put him in this mental hospital in Westwood. And I couldn't see him, and I called Eric Byrne, and Byrne called the doctors down there, and he said, no. They said he's acute schizophrenic. He's in a room. You were with some man who used to be in a concentration camp, and you wanted to commit suicide. You wanted to die, and you were screaming and yelling, and they said you were suicidal. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. In this particular case, this Dr. Olson jumped out a window in New York City, you know, on this kind of a testing program. And there's thousands of people, the CIA's throw away the records of them, but...
The thing is, like, my mind and my body didn't go at the same time. First, my body started having these strange reactions, and then all of a sudden, there was that one night where I went down to sleep, and I woke up with this incredible pain, and all of a sudden, like, I think some of my first words after I went upstairs and told you about it was, you know, like, I've been poisoned.
Yeah.
And after that, like, nobody would, after you're labeled schizophrenic, people just don't believe what you say, they only categorize
it. And then you became a paranoid schizophrenic.
Yeah,
and now
started my career as a schizophrenic
for
a while.
And now come the Beverly Hills doctors who said he's acute schizophrenic and we couldn't visit you, and they locked Marvin up at Mount Sinai Hospital. And then made arrangements to send him to Chestnut Lodge back in Maryland, which turned out to be a CIA hospital run by the military.
End of my, well, my contract burned out with Bobby Darin.
Well,
I was no longer on the payroll, and I was a political prisoner and chemically castrated on Thorazine and Stelazine.
Then came the Thorazine, then came the Stelazine, and Dr. Byrne had claimed that it was impossible to be a paranoid schizophrenic, that the group thing was a very open and free relationship, and that he said there was some kind of a poisoning induced.
Right, and I had a lot of respect for Eric Byrne's opinion, and looking back on the entire thing, you'd have to agree with me, you know, I had my hang-ups like everybody else, but you have to agree with me that, like, up until the age of 19, end of that summer, ingestion of that pill.
Things were going
And 2 weeks after that, you know, I was a perfectly healthy, functioning, total human being who was really, really doing well in the world, you know, just according to my own standards at the time.
Yeah, I think it also puts you on the defensive, I know, out in social things now because of series of getting well and going downhill or getting well again, that you have to always be afraid that other people are going to reappear and offer you food or drinks that will happen to you. I know that this happened to Marvin when I was in New Orleans. I had introduced myself to Jim Garrison, who had arrested Clay Shaw, and I'd gone down for that trial, and Clay Shaw had been in the CIA and David Ferry, and I was away from the situation. And the reason I feel free to mention these people on the air, and if they want to come forward or have time to discuss the whole situation with me, is that if they were friends, they invited you to stay at their house and write your songs there and so forth. If they were really friends and you had a breakdown, they would just come forward like friends did and come to the house and socialize. When I came home from New Orleans and my luggage was kept there, and they said there was a bomb on the plane. And
I'll tell you exactly what happened. I arrived back at the house at the Highlands not knowing that anything had gone wrong on your trip to New Orleans, and Peter was sitting out in the front yard. And when I got up there, he said, something happened in New Orleans. And I was freaked out because I didn't even want to guess in my mind what might have happened in New Orleans. You know, and I said, what happened? He said, I don't want to tell you. I won't tell you. I can't tell you. You know, go home. Just go home and talk to them. Well, when I got home and found you there, like, I must have heaved the biggest sigh of relief in my entire life.
But he wouldn't tell
but
you.
No, he wouldn't just tell me, you know, May's okay, etc., like, go home and you'll hear what happened in New Orleans. He just wouldn't tell me, period.
And then he took powder.
Saying, May all right, you know? He wouldn't respond to any of that. And I had to drive 15 miles with that on my mind, you know, and it was horrible. I don't know what the secretiveness was about on his part, but that was...
And so then after you had this particular poison, it takes years to wear off. It's a thing that stays in your system. It's like those men that were at the American Legion in Philadelphia, you know, that had this poisoning, and 27 have died now or more, and 125 were sick. The poison in their bodies that maybe relapse or stay with them for a long, long time. And
so it's something that I went through, like, I can only look back and see that pill as the only thing different that I'd done in my life that might have caused the reaction I suffered 2 weeks later, but,
Well, it's the thing about this experimentation on LSD, and we're talking about not normal LSD, we're talking about the government, the kind they made, and by their own admission, they're inducing schizophrenia. No,
there was something I wanted to add, like, the healing process from a mental or emotional breakdown is often like a healing, cracking thing. And as it was with me, it was very hard. It took me about 4 years to finally get my head out of it completely because, at least from my experience with the drug Thorazine and Stelazine, like, I couldn't have a sex life until I had not been on the drug, I mean, until I'd been off the drug for 6 months. So when I finally got the psychiatrist to stop the drug, you know, it took me 6 months to be able to feel physically good again and to be potent in that sense.
Can you imagine how many people they have given these medications to? Richard Helms was the head of the CIA, and before he left to be the ambassador to Iran, he destroyed all records of who he had given this to, these LSDs, the poison ones, mm-hmm. and these drugs that induce schizophrenia. He destroyed that. So how many people are going around thinking they have mental diseases or they're failures in society or they can't go back to working at normal jobs or creative, like, say, if you were into certain things at the university, you happen to have a lot of good medical care and yeah. your father invested. It was literally, even though his father's a doctor, he spent $30,000 or $40,000 just yeah. stabilizing situations, you know, that other families can't afford. We happen to be fortunate yeah. in that he's a pediatrician in Los Angeles and he invested this money in your welfare. But how many people in this country, young people with new ideas that have dropped out or creative or whose parents are into research, people like Madame New, she had said the CIA killed her husband in South Vietnam, and right after that her daughter was killed in a car crash outside the Sorbonne. How many children are poisoned?
Honestly, there's one thing that just crossed my mind, and that is, like, at the time that I cracked up for the first time, you know, I really felt like there was some kind of future in my life. To be employed by Darren was really important to me, because had it not been for him, the public wouldn't have known about people like Tim Harden or Roger McGuinn of the Byrds, say, who worked for Bobby 2 years prior to the time he started the group. And he was instrumental in finding people and bringing them into public attention. He did that for more people than most people are aware of. And, you know, finally, after, I guess it's been almost 10 years, I'm getting my life, my career, back on the tracks and getting back, you know, into the commercial mainstream. And
you're one of the fortunate.
I just hope that I can start here and go and continue without having to fear the cracking process again after the healing that I've done. And I think I stand a better chance this time of making it all the way through and getting out of it.
And also not letting people put things into drinks unsuspecting, like mm-hmm. they did it before. People say to me in the research, has your life ever been threatened? Have you ever been in danger? But I don't think listeners realize, or maybe they do, how it affects family life, how it affects your children. And for direct experiences, we've had all kinds of things in our family. Mm-hmm. But I did want to share this with a listening audience, because when I read in the New York Times just this week, and Dialogue Conspiracy is a format of weekly news, when I read a report now that just came out, this Army report, that says that they administered these drugs to create an exaggerated mental state of schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. Not to cure a schizophrenia, but to create it. And then what happens is that these large drug companies, again, the drug companies supported Richard Nixon, and John Mitchell was the attorney mm-hmm. for drug companies, and then comes in, after they create schizophrenia, they create the control, and the drug companies mm-hmm. make the drugs, like they make the swine vaccine. Mm-hmm. And how many people walking out at large are suffering
and
not
productive? I really wonder, because I have a feeling that in my experiences in hospitals that I was continually surrounded by victims. I can think of very few people there who weren't just
total victims.
They were just plain victims. They were circumstantially like moved like little pawns into those places. Mm-hmm. Some of them incredibly gifted and broken.
I know.
For no reason, they did no harm, etc. When you think about the government giving poison to people, you got to remember that cancer starts with one cell, and that's all they have to affect in a human being to totally crack them.
And to take away their mind and to begin these heavy doses, and they walk around the hospitals like zombies. And there were many young people when you were in there whose
victims.
Their lives were just crushed.
If the doors of the mental hospitals are open and you found out the exact circumstances that brought each person there, you know, this listening audience would be outraged.
I know.
Political prisoners in every single room, doped up.
And what is the excuse of producing those dopes was the government-induced schizophrenia mm-hmm. by their own admission. Mm-hmm. There's a lawsuit now in New York, a woman whose father died and he was injected, and three of the doctors involved who simulated his schizophrenia said that he should have had some kind of a test. He died from a very painful arteriosclerosis wasn't tested, and they started injecting him with these fatal experiments on schizophrenia. His name is Mr. Blauer, and he died, and his daughter has a lawsuit.
It's funny, if you know, the people in the hospital say, if they say something to the effect that they've been poisoned, or that someone else is responsible for their imprisonment.
Then they say they're paranoid.
Then they up the dosage. You know,
they say
they're crazier. So you can't say anything that you know is controversial, which is not freedom of speech.
Because
freedom of speech is punished, and it's happening right behind the doors of every single mental hospital in this country, including behind the door of Carmel Community Hospital.
Oh, the Garden Pavilion.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I remember when you went in there and were having a relapse, and they gave you an injection of Prolexin for a 2-week dose,
mm-hmm.
with no past history, and it's the last thing you should have.
Right. Well, yeah. We out of time?
Well, I think it's just time.
The story of the Prolexin is interesting because you're going to wind up?
Yeah, we got to wind up. We've got maybe next week we'll do some more. We could do a continuation. This is it for next week. Dialogue Conspiracy, we could keep going, but the tapes run out, and we do send them away and out of the state. So take it easy, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, Mark, for telling about it. It's a hard thing to talk about.
Thanks for having me on, May.
Yeah, it's a hard thing. Bye-bye.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist May Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.